My guest is Leonard Maltin. He reports on film for the TV show Entertainment Tonight. But film buffs know him also as the author of Leonard Maltin's TV Movies and Video Guide, which he's edited since 1969. The new 1988 edition lists more than 17,000 movies that are likely to show up on television. Each entry includes a capsule summary, running time, the film's director and leading actors, year of release, and whether it's available on home video. Maltin told me that he and his staff of devoted moviegoers continually have to update and revise the guide.
We who work on it call it the book that never ends, because it's not just a matter of keeping track of the new movies and seeing them and writing them up, but also keeping track of the kind of little nitty-gritty details that turn up, not only with the new movies, but of course with older movies or even recent movies and the way they get treated on television or dealt with on videotape. So it's just an ongoing job that could only be done by people who really love movies.
When you started this book, you were 17 years old. How did you end up getting a job like that?
I was literally in the right place at the right time. I had been publishing and editing a little film buff magazine when I was in my teens, and a high school teacher of mine got me an introduction to an editor at New American Library in New York City. And it was just supposed to be a social introduction. She said, I think the two of you would really enjoy meeting each other. So I went to see him, and of course, with ideas dancing in my head that maybe I could write a book for him sometime. And I brought copies of my magazine. And when he saw it, he said, is that your magazine? I said, yeah. He said, oh, I love it. And he'd seen it before. He knew it very well. And that kind of broke the ice. And he was looking for somebody to do this kind of book. And 3 days later, we were making a deal for me to do it. But he didn't have the nerve to tell the publishing house that he was hiring a 17-year-old kid to do it. So we wrote the contract out to Film Fan Monthly, which was the name of my magazine. And that way my father didn't have to countersign for a minor.
How many of the movies do you see yourself that are in the guide?
I haven't ever counted. Obviously, being the boss, being in the top position, it gives me the privilege of choosing what I want to review. And so I try to review everything I see, and I see a lot of movies. I see 5 or 6 a week. Old and new.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm pretty dominant in this book, but at the same time, no one person could review everything because no one can see everything that comes out. And that's why I'm lucky to have a staff of people with me who are all, you know, really dedicated and intelligent movie watchers and movie writers.
Have you revised any of your earlier ratings in your new volume? Is your new volume any different in its star ratings or in its review of the movie?
Yeah, we go back all the time. If I'm channel flipping and I come upon a movie that I haven't seen in a while and I watch it again, or if I go to a film festival or a revival and I see a movie again I haven't seen in a long time, I find quite often my opinion may differ. It may not be a drastic change, but there may be certain things about the film that strike me differently or that don't hold up the way I thought they did. And this is true for the other people who work with me on the book. We all have that experience. And we feel it's important to have fresh opinions in the book, to have, if it's a 1987 or 88 book, they should be 1988 opinions. They shouldn't be 1968 opinions.
Is there an example of a movie that you caught on late night TV that made you revise your opinion?
Well, I can't think of one specifically. I can tell you that one thing that has happened to me is that the more I go back to certain old movies, the better and better they look. This is kind of a phenomenon, I think, of our time, that so many films that come out these days leave you wanting, that when you go back to a Hitchcock or you go back to a great comedy or you go back to one of those personality vehicles for a Bogart or a Gable or whoever it may be, you say to yourself, gee, this is just so entertaining. Why carp? You know, why was I being so stingy in my praise for this? It may not be a great movie, but compared to so much of what you see today, it's just so entertaining. So I find that I keep increasing the ratings on a lot of those older films because they just look better and better with age.
Well, I'm still waiting for you to increase your rating of Taxi Driver, which you give 2 stars and you describe it as ugly and unredeeming. Maybe next year it'll get 3 or 4, huh?
All right, I promise that I'll look at it again. I give you my word, I will look at it again.
One of the things that's very handy about your guide is that it gives a running time for each movie that's on TV. And it's very helpful to see if the TV station is cheating when they're running the movie. They frequently cut the film so that they could fit it into their 90 or 90-minute or 2-hour slot and still have time for commercials. I've heard some pretty grisly stories about what TV stations sometimes do to shorten those movies. What are the truths about that? Do you know, are TV stations very insensitive when it comes time to shorten a movie to fit it into the time slot?
I've witnessed some horror stories, and I've heard some horror stories about that. And you'd think that that wouldn't be done much anymore. But now even the networks do it. They just don't like a movie to run an odd time. They don't want it to run 2 hours and 10 minutes or, you know, 1 hour and 47 minutes. They want it to come out even. As to what's happened in the past, I hope we'll never see this kind of thing again. I once watched Singin' in the Rain on New York television on a 4:30 movie where they just cut whole musical numbers. They just cut them, whacked them right out. And one time I watched Anchors Away, which I'd never seen. I was young and I wanted to see this because I'd always heard about that great sequence where Gene Kelly dances with Jerry the Mouse, the animated mouse. It wasn't there. And the reason is that, you know, when an editor's got to quickly, and he never has much time, cut those films for local TV broadcast, the easiest thing to cut is a musical number. It doesn't interfere with the plot. Oh, dear. I mean, the things they would do.
In your new guide, you indicate which movies are now available on home video. Is there any logic behind what is being released? Who makes the decision?
The decisions are made by marketing people, I guess, mostly, because there doesn't seem to be any logic, Terry. None at all. The number of wonderful movies that aren't available on home video is staggering. Absolutely staggering. Great films. Not just films that are great because I or you or some film buff says they're great, but films that still have staying power, that have reputations. The Oxbow Incident with Henry Fonda, or Young Mr. Lincoln with Henry Fonda, which you'd think there'd be a ready audience for. Those are a couple of examples that I just realized recently weren't out. Of course, there are some legal complications keeping some films away, like The Last Picture Show has so much music in it. And when they made that film, they never reckoned with home video and didn't buy the rights to those songs to play it on home video. So they've had to try to worm their way around a tough negotiation there. Same thing with John Sayles' film, Baby, It's You. You know what they've done with a film like The Breakfast Club or 16 Candles, where there were so many songs on the background, soundtrack, is in some cases when they went to negotiate those rights to put it out on home video and the publisher held out for a lot of money, the studio just said, well, the heck with it then. We'll put in some other songs on the soundtrack. And that's what they did. So the home video version actually has some different music in it.
Talk about integrity.
Yeah, exactly. It's again, Terry, you know, it's amazing how many films just get treated, still, these days, still get treated as product.
Do a lot of newspapers steal your listings and use them for their Sunday TV guide supplements?
Steal is such a harsh word. Obviously, you know, this is a reference book, and it's meant to be referred to. So I know that almost every newspaper person I've ever met tells me that they use my book to do their TV listings, and it's meant for that, so that's fine. Once in a while, they use it a little too assiduously.
Your book used to be the TV Movie Guide, edited by Leonard Maltin, but now that you're on TV, your name's above the credits, and it's Leonard Maltin's TV Movies and Video Guide, and there's a picture of you, too, now that you have a recognizable face.
That is the single most satisfying result of my being on television, bar none. People say, how did television change your life or what's different? I say, what's different is I got a call one day from my publisher saying they wanted to put my name above the title and my picture on the cover. And I said, to think that I lived long enough to see that happen.
You know, when I use your book or my friends, we call it Maltin. Like, look it up in Maltin. I think you're becoming a brand name. Not a brand name, but what do you call it? Like if
a generic?
Somebody, a generic, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Like if someone calls a tissue a Kleenex.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm very honored. I think that's very nice.
Well, happy movie watching, and thanks a lot for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Terry.
Leonard Maltin is the editor of Leonard Maltin's TV Movies and Video Guide, published by New American Library.